Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the show today. It seems that on top of all the bad news that we have from other sectors, it seems that we're going to be heading into a striking December, a pre-Christmas strike festive season.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, a different profession striking pretty much every day in December. That seems to be the headline. You've got rail workers, nurses, driving examiners. We know that the paramedics and the ambulance workers have now joined the nurses in strike action this month. Eurostar security workers have also voted for 4 days of strike. We know that the RMT is already on strike. This is getting really pretty serious for the UK.
And it's now getting to a point where it looks like anyone who's going to be travelling anywhere before Christmas is essentially going to be facing some sort of disruption. So if anyone manages to get to their dinner table at Christmas time, they could be very fraught by then.
Yeah, look, I'm not that... Listen, if the Eurostar security workers strike and you can't get to Paris, I'm less bothered than I have.
What about
I
the people who live in Paris and want to get home?
Yeah, no, that, of course. But listen, the paramedics surely are far more important. Have you ever had to call a paramedic?
I have. It's not an experience I'd like to repeat.
Absolutely not. I have my, of course, which is my usual dinner party story. The only time I've ever had to call a paramedic in the UK was when I was delivering the baby of one of my sisters. Yeah, it was hair raising. The paramedics are amazing. Immensely difficult moment. So yes, rare bit of good news though. The bus drivers in North and West London have actually called off one of their
So you should be able to get home from work today. Yes. That's good. Okay. Less good news, though, for the Conservative Party from the latest poll from YouGov showing another fall in support for the party, down 3 points. The gap now even wider with Labour. Labour's lead is 25 points now in the poll, 47% according to YouGov, 22% for the Conservatives. The Lib Dems steady at 9%. Not a great day to be looking at it from a government point of view anyway.
No, but I do want to bring you a little bit of Christmas cheer. It's the 1st of December. This means we can break out the tinsel and we're going to review some of this year's Christmas ads. Which one bring a tear to the eye? Which ones you're going to be cheering for and which ones are going to get you to spend a bit extra?
We can both wear our Christmas tree earrings next week, Caroline, to get ourselves in the mood.
I might be serious for that. Yeah, okay.
Who said that I wasn't? Anyway, right. That's some of the other stories that we're watching out for today. But we want to talk to you now about a story to do with the gambling industry and in particular the explosion of online gambling in recent years. Today's Bloomberg Big Take looks at the sector's growth and the apparent lack of regulation here in the UK. Joining us now is Bloomberg's Gavin Finch, who worked on this story. Gavin, great to have you with us. It's just a matter of years, really, that the gambling industry has gone from betting shops to a huge online market. How fast has that evolution been?
That's right. Well, it's been really fast. So revenues from online gambling in the UK were about £27 million in 2014. And today that's more like £4 billion. So you can see there the growth has just been huge. And that transformation can all be traced back to the advent of the smartphone, really. In the last 10 years, you've seen this complete shift away from physical bookmakers to online gambling. You know, suddenly people have this kind of portable device with a large screen, you know, internet connection, lots of processing power. And it was perfect for these online casino games. And gambling companies have spent a lot of time since then and money designing these games to be as highly attractive and habit forming as possible. So yeah, you no longer need to walk into some forbidding looking gambling store to bet. You can do it on your commute, on the sofa, in bed. You know, everyone's got a virtual casino in their pocket now.
And gamification, it's the numbers in your story, Gavin, are just extraordinary. Basically, Britain's now the biggest online gambling market, regulated online gambling market in the world. During the pandemic, also, there was kind of a flashpoint, wasn't there, when the numbers, the sort of stark numbers of how this is affecting people in the UK sort of came to the fore. It's slightly subsided again. But what are the protections for all of these people who are now, what, losing money, making money in this online gambling extravaganza?
Yeah, so the UK's largely outsource consumer protection to the addicts. You know, you're expected to self-exclude from gambling websites if you develop a problem. And you do that via a platform called GamStop, which all UK online gambling firms are forced to sign up to. But it's a pretty flawed system, not least that you know, addicts generally don't make the best decisions. But it's also very easy to get around. You know, there are hundreds of websites out there with tips on how to do it. You just have to change sort of some of the details in your name and use a middle name, or change your surname, or a different postcode or something, and you can get around it. But you alluded to the problem of problem gambling, and the statistics really are stark. So there's a House of Lords report which reckoned that 60% of the industry's profits, and that's, you're looking at a number of around £14 billion a year, 60% of that comes from only 5% of its customers. So these are many of these will be your problem gamblers. They reckon there's probably about as many as 138,000 people in England classified as a problem gambler.
The thing is, I remember when that Lords report came out and we covered it on Bloomberg Radio. And even then there was a huge clamour to do something about it, that it was such a minority of individuals who were providing the industry with so much money. And so what's been done in the intervening time period?
There have been various attempts to tighten the rules over the years, but generally not a great deal has been done. There's been some sort of tinkering at the edges, but for the most part, the gambling industry has been very effective at lobbying successive UK governments that it should be left alone. You know, they've got lots of persuasive arguments, including the economic contribution they make to the country in terms of tax and number of people they employ. But, you know, critics point to the fact that none of that really takes into account the cost to the NHS of dealing with the consequences of gambling addiction and, you know, and the other fallouts. You know, they reckon there's as many as 400 suicides a year linked to gambling addiction.
And on top of that, this industry has put an awful lot of money behind its lobbying efforts. And that's something else that you touch on in the story.
Yeah, so the industry has spent hundreds of thousands of pounds cultivating politicians of every different party. You know, that lobbying intensified significantly since 2019, when the Conservatives under Boris Johnson promised in their election manifesto a review of the 2005 Gambling Act. Since then, so since 2019, the sector spent more than £300,000 on wages and entertainment for about 37 different lawmakers. And what we found was that on numerous occasions, these lawmakers would then speak in favour of the industry in parliamentary debates, you know, within weeks really of being schmoozed in these hospitality suites at, you know, England football internationals or Adele concerts. And that's what we found.
Gavin, I think it's fantastic that you've done the legwork, the difficult task of actually working out, going through the members' registers of interests, I imagine, and piecing together who is being, you know, who is receiving these sorts of benefits, and then kind of looking at their record. I think that is immensely important. Do you think that there will be any shift then in terms of regulation? Because the other perhaps big prompt here is that the US may be going in this direction soon too. And in your piece, I notice the comparison between the gaming firms in the UK and the firms in the US that pushed opioids in America. I thought that was quite a stark comparison.
Yeah, so that was the view of Stuart Kenny. He was a former executive at Paddy Power, one of the co-founders there. And that was his view. He compares UK gambling companies to these pharmaceutical companies who knowingly are pushing a product that they know is having social harm. The US is virgin territory for these gambling companies. And what's happened here in the UK in the last decade, the surging rates of gambling addiction, the hundreds of suicides every year, it's an object lesson in the dangers confronting the US as it emerges as this kind of new frontier. Most US states have now liberalized their gambling laws in the last couple of years to allow online gambling. And all the big gambling companies from Europe are queuing up around the block to try and repeat the same sort of financial successes they've had here.
Is there any likelihood that regulation could be tightened here? Are there efforts underway to try and change that?
Yeah, so the government announced this review of gambling legislation in 2019. Now, that's been delayed at least four times, as you know, there's been some political chaos here. But there's also been a lot of intensive lobbying. Just last summer, after intensive lobbying, there was a significant watering down of the proposals. Now, what is finally going to come out? We're expecting this white paper to be published probably some point before Christmas. Mm-hmm. But what exactly is going to be in it is still, up for grabs. That lobbying is still going on. Some of the measures that could be in it that certainly were proposed would be a ban on advertising, gambling companies advertising on the front of football players' shirts.
Okay.
That was something that was taken out last summer, but that could well be put back into the white paper. Another thing that the so-called reformers are calling for is affordability checks. So when a gambler's losses hit a certain point, the firm will then be compelled to get in touch and check, whether these people can actually afford to lose that much money.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The UK housing market is undergoing a correction. Nationwide has reported a 1.4% drop in house prices in November, the largest decline since the early days of the pandemic. Annual price growth has decelerated sharply to 4.4% from 7.2% in October.
Yeah, all of that coming after the Bank of England reported that mortgage approvals have also dropped by almost 20% in the last couple of months. So let's delve into what's going on with the housing market. Earlier this morning, Tom McKenzie and I spoke to Lucien Cook, who's the head of residential research for the estate agent Savills. And we talked a bit about actually the government's role in the property market.
I think the difficulty you had with that stamp duty holiday, which in hindsight looks as incredibly generous as, as the foresight of the Bank of England with that mortgage regulation looks visionary now, when at the time we thought it was draconian, was as soon as they mentioned the possibility of a stamp duty holiday, their hands were tied. Had they not come good on that, they would have stalled the market, essentially. So as soon as they announced it was a possibility, they almost had to follow through with it. I mean, I would be incredibly surprised, given the giveaway that we've already seen around stamp duty, the fact that in the last budget that now is time limited, that they will do an awful lot more than that. My suspicion is that their main focus will be on existing borrowers and reducing the financial burden upon those. So I would imagine they will be talking quite heavily to the banking industry and saying, okay, how are you going to help the people who are coming to the end of their fixed rate deal? And I think there you will see quite a lot of forbearance from the banks. I think they've learned their lessons from the early 1990s around that. And whilst I don't think you'll see wholesale mortgage holidays, you could see, for example, mortgage terms pushed out for borrowers. They may have a holiday on the capital repayment element of their mortgage. That's another option that the banks will be looking at, just to ease the pressures on that part of society.
What, fundamentally, and we were talking about building 300,000 homes just briefly, longer term, does that shore up this market? Does that put a foundation under the sheer lack of homes?
Yeah, well, look, the government has got itself in a real muddle around house building and house building targets. It supported the house building industry significantly through Help to Buy for a period. And the changes that it put in place to have pretty rigid house building targets at a local level, again, meant that the house builders have been operating in very strong trading market conditions. But as much as the housing market has gone through this change, so the conditions for those house builders have changed quite dramatically. They now don't have the support of Help to Buy. They're facing much more difficult market conditions with particular pressures on first-time buyers. I think it'll be first-time buyers and buy-to-let investors who probably bear the brunt of these affordability issues.
So that was Lucien Cook from Savills speaking to us a little earlier on Bloomberg Radio. And in the studio with us now is John Stepek, who is the author of Bloomberg's Money Distilled newsletter. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for talking to us. Look, I wanted to play a bit of that Savills sound because, yes, we talked about, you know, the nationwide figures and what they show about home prices, but also about the government. And I want to start there. How much is the government to blame for, again, kind of fueling home prices in the run-up to then this big jump in interest rate, the stamp duty cut, the Help to Buy? Why does the government keep doing this, and yet when it comes to building more homes, can't achieve the target?
Well, look, it's a good question. There's a fairly straightforward answer, which is that one of those things is easy and one of those things is hard. The stamp duty cut was stupid, and it was pouring fuel on the fire even at the time. The Help to Buy, probably the biggest scandal, but Help to Buy really, is that it was a massive subsidy for the big house.
Yeah, for builders, the home builders.
Rather than anything that really helped to get more homes built or helped first-time buyers who are now, of course, stuck on the ladder at the most vulnerable bit of the rung. So all of those things are bad, but at the end of the day, they're politically easy and they're politically relatively popular because you get a lot of anger amongst first-time buyers because they can't afford property. The reason they can't afford property is because interest rates have been too low for too long and they've driven up house prices. And the vast majority of the house price issue is about credit. That is absolutely not to say that physical supply is not important. It's not to say we shouldn't be building more houses. But the reason that house prices are falling just now is because interest rates have gone up. And on that point, the one thing I would say is that fundamentally, you know, governments across the board have helped to fuel that because it's been politically popular. But, you know, the other stupid thing that was done was that the Bank of England poured a load of QE into the markets during the pandemic, and that was not necessary. And I think lots of Bank of England policymakers, to their credit, already say, actually, that was a mistake. We did too much quantitative easing. Because, you know, we had, I mean, prices have gone up by about 20%. You know, during the global plague, how...
I'm not just in the UK either, it has to be said.
Absolutely.
You know, it's problematic as well. Look, people who are now in the difficult position of looking at house prices falling, how bad does this downturn look in the context of something that you've been looking at in the newsletter earlier in the week?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what analysts are saying broadly at the moment, most of them are kind of coalescing around a 10% drop. Now, that's 10% in nominal terms, so... You know, in real terms, after inflation, that's actually quite a big drop. I mean, you're probably talking about 20% odds just now. One thing I would say is that these, though, you know, they're kind of playing catch up. I mean, it's interesting. I was looking at Lloyd's. Lloyd's releases a forecast with its annual, sorry, its quarterly results. Its worst case scenario is now house prices will fall 18% next year. Now, a quarter ago, its worst case scenario was that prices will fall 14%. So I think what you see these things getting adjusted all the way down.
The worst case scenario is getting worse.
Yeah, and so I guess, you know, somewhere between 10-20% sounds realistic, particularly if you look back at past house price crashes.
Yes, they've been of a similar order. Yeah, I think that's also the thing that is really interesting, because I think it was over the summer that Bloomberg's Neil Callanan wrote a really important piece in, it was in those 2 weeks when basically a lot of people were on holiday in August, put out a very important note saying, look, this you know, crisis is coming. And now in the space of 2 months, we've seen such a swift change. So it's the speed of change that is also quite hair-raising.
Aye, absolutely. The speed has been, because the thing is, mortgage rates were creeping up and it was clear that this was going to be an issue. It's not surprising that house prices are going to fall, because we knew that interest rates were going up. But the problem is that obviously the speed of the adjustment in the UK has been very fast, because we went from kind of just creeping towards it. Then we had the mini budget. That happened at the same time as a lot of other things happened in global markets, and basically we got a massive jump in borrowing costs. I mean,
so politically, what's going to happen, do you think? Because are we going back to the 90s? Stephen, you probably don't remember the 90s in London. But, well, in London,
when it was the famous
moment. And it was very, very difficult for families and people that were evicted, etc. That's not going to happen again.
No, I don't see that happening, because we have a very different mortgage market for a start. I mean, very roughly speaking, a third of people own their homes outright, a third of people rent, and a third of people have got mortgages. Of the people who've got mortgages, the majority of them are more comfortably off than the average person, because, you know, that's how we've ended up, because house prices are so high in the first place. You have to be comfortably off to get on the ladder. So the mortgage market is nowhere near, or sorry, the housing market is nowhere near as vulnerable as it was in the 1990s. It can still get very uncomfortable, but basically it mostly boils down to what is the scale of any recession that we now face. If unemployment goes up a lot, then basically all bets are off, because that's when you start, you know, people actually cannot afford their homes anymore.
Right.
I do think we'll get more forbearance than perhaps we would have in the 1990s. I think the banks obviously are still trying to polish their halos after the 2008 financial crisis. So they do not want to be cast in the role of the bad guys again. Yeah. And I do think the Savills chart was right in terms of, there's lots of ways to extend and pretend.
Yes.
You know, move people to interest only.
Yes.
You don't have explicit mortgage holidays, but they are basically kind of mortgage holidays.
Which is a little bit what happened in the pandemic in terms of giving renters relief, you know, and moratoriums against conviction, etc. John Sepik, so great to have you in the studio. Lovely to see you. Author of Bloomberg's Money Distilled newsletter, with all of, well, the look at the nationwide house price survey and...
And everything else that we need to be worried about if you're either trying to buy or sell a home. Thanks very much, John. Let's turn to something a little bit more cheery. It's the 1st of December. Have you been watching television in the past couple of days? Then you might have seen some of these Christmas ads. Take a listen.
Hey, Ellie.
Hi.
Oh, yeah. I'd skate a bit too.
You want to come in?
There are some Christmas traditions we can't live without. And then there are new ones like...
Football.
Wow.
So, this festive season...
Give me football.
Britain, there's a joy shortage. So we at Tesco have formed the Christmas party to help. We promise more pigs in more blankets for more people.
What? Marvellous gift, Sam, but you shouldn't have spent so much on us.
Didn't. Just went to TK Maxx.
Okay, I don't know if you spotted the brands there. We had clips there from Mind the Squawking Bird. Clips there from the John Lewis ad, Sports Direct, that was the footballers, Tesco and TK Maxx there at the end. Carolyn, you had a conversation earlier with Ollie Miller, who's the Associate Creative Director from Pangolin, reviews Christmas ads every year.
He does it for Ad Week, so I thought he was a great ad man to come in and talk to us about the Christmas ads. Look, I think what I took away from the conversation with Ollie is that that a lot of those ads do go viral, and that the main theme this year is all about the cost of living, but they've had to dress it up as something a bit more cheery, because talking about the cost of living crisis is really grim.
And also the idea of, like, you know, what really people stand out is the heartstrings. And I think, you know, it's a thing that John Lewis has become famous for.
Absolutely. And everyone shares it. And it was a lovely advert sort of in support of adopting children, which, you know, really nice Christmas message.
Yes, there's a seasonal message for you on this 1st of December. Thank you for joining us on Bloomberg UK Politics. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and rate wherever you usually listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or indeed you can also find it on the Bloomberg website.
Yep, we'll be back. Same time tomorrow. This episode was hosted by me, Caroline Hepke.
And me, Stephen Carroll. John Wasserman was on sound. Special thanks to our producer, Chris Pitt. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.